First
Okay.
of all, to congratulate you because
Oh, thank
we
you.
choose once a year a progressive person, and it has always been activists and ministers and commissioners and all these type of people. And now we'd like to not only highlight your academic contribution, but also your involvement in the political debate, because we welcomed you at the PES Congress. Your video message was fantastic. I also saw you addressing the PD conference on industrial policy, and I could also list other ones. So my first question is, what is your motivation to be much more active in politics than many of your fellow professors?
Ah, interesting. There's a wonderful radio show called Desert Island Discs. Do you know it? It's the
No.
best. Anyway, it's a long story, but it's BBC. They interview, in theory, famous people. They ask them to talk about their life, and you need to choose eight songs. And one of the songs that I chose was "Which Side Are You On?" Because I do think that's the point, which is economists and academics like to pretend that we always have to be objective, but how we do our research, how the assumptions underlie our theory, it's never objective. It's always subjective. Economics is a, how do you say, it's a social science. It's not a physical science. So there's all sorts of different assumptions, not with human behavior. And for me, I think so many of the problematic things I see out there are inability to take seriously the climate crisis, our lack of reflection on how to design better instead of parasitic public-private partnerships. I believe we have parasitic, not symbiotic, public-private partnerships. These are decisions we make. There's nothing inevitable. So for me, trying to convince policymakers they need to better understand how economics has embodied within it very problematic assumptions, which then determine what happens on the ground. And it's very hard to have better results, whether it's on inequality, on climate change, on the financialization of the economy, without new economic thinking. And vice versa, something I said at my institute is that we take seriously working with policymakers and we try to bring back to the theory the lessons we learn on the ground. And we call this practice-based theorizing. So I'm just as interested in the theory as the policy and the practice and the politics, but the dynamic between the two, I think, will make both better.
Is it too simple to say that progressive politics requires progressive economics? And I'm asking this because indeed a lot of people consider economics a very technocratic, politics neutral science. So how do you see the scope for progressive economic policy in the market systems today?
Okay, so first of all, the word progressive economics, I think, has led to lazy economics. It doesn't really mean much, no? Like, what we want is progressive results. Economics has to be the theory of how we understand how the world works. I mean, how the economy works. It's not necessarily progressive or not progressive. The question is, what do we do with it? What do we do with those economic tools to render the world, the planet, our cities, our regions, our nations progressive in the sense of more sustainable, more inclusive, right? So less inequality, a more productive investment instead of just financialized, assets being bought and sold, and of course tackling the biggest problems of our time, from water to biodiversity to climate. So the word progressive economics, I actually think, is part of the problem, which is it kind of leads to lazy economics. What does the state do in the capitalist economy? Is it fixing market failures, or is it actively shaping the market? That's not a normative point. You can shape markets in a terrible way, markets that end up, creating all sorts of problems, but you're still shaping and not fixing. But the theory is about fixing versus shaping. So the traditional theory says that at best, the public sector can fix a market failure, whereas my work, drawing on the work of Karl Polanyi, has been much more about shaping. Then how do you make that shaping of markets instead of fixing a market lead to progressive outcomes? You need very particular tools and instruments and designs of public-private, relationships, so on and so forth. Anyway, and another issue is I think young people have, in the movement for rethinking economics, have gone overboard on saying that economics is technocratic. They say, oh, there's too much mathematics. Whereas my point is, no, there's the wrong mathematics. There's mathematics from Newtonian physics. Mm-hmm. Should be mathematics from biology. Of course, we also need case studies. It can't just be mathematical. It shouldn't just be technical. Of course, we need qualitative studies. But it shouldn't be just an accusation, oh, they have too much math and we need to bring it back down to a more user-friendly. Because you can have all the problems of the theory that I and others have highlighted, even in non-mathematical economics. So I don't really buy the technocratic bit either. I think for me, autonomous who tries her best, you know, to both nurture new students through PhD program and master's program, to work with policymakers, to, you know, so on and so forth, is to bring the lessons on the ground. What we learned, for example, of how to design a development bank in a way that can actually foster a green transition, to the theory of development banks, to the theory of public finance. So the arrows going both ways, not using new economic understanding, new economic thinking to drive a progressive economy, not so much economics, progressive economy. And on the ground, when you open the can of worms, whether it's the CHIPS Act in the US, whether it's what Lula is trying to do with ecological transition, and in particular, the use of a very active public bank in Brazil called BNDES, bringing those lessons back to the theory. So that's about dynamic, static economics, bringing, you know, the lived experience also from the policymaking side back to make the theory itself better.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Now I would like to draw you to the EU policy debate, namely the Draghi report.
Yes.
Because in the last 1 year or a little bit longer, the EU has been focusing on competitiveness, maybe obsessed with competitiveness. And I really wonder what you think about this discussion about the Draghi report and how exactly the EU leadership has been using it.
Right. Good point. So the reason I wrote The Entrepreneurial State back in 2013 was to combat the false myths that in some ways have come back into the Draghi report, which is, you know, we need to spend more on research and development. We need to have a unified also demand because, of course, you know, when you have the U.S. Department of Defense using its, you know, procurement budget to allow, you know, startups to scale up, that's much more than we have, say, in Europe, where we're all divided up into our little markets, where this assumption that we just need more venture capital, you know, so on and so forth. So what I tried to show was actually the ecosystem in the U.S. has ironically been with a much more visible hand, not invisible hand, than in Europe. Not only because they had much more, you know, research and development spending and all stuff like that, but the institutions they have across the whole innovation chain, from the upstream basic research to the midstream applied research to the more downstream public venture capital funds, not private venture capital funds, InQtel, which is the CIA's very large public venture capital fund, has been central to providing patient long-term finance. And the SBIR program, which means that every government department in the U.S. government has to spend 5% of its budgets to procure in innovations from small, medium enterprises, and also other demand-side policies. All of these have allowed U.S. companies to grow and to benefit from huge amounts of public sector innovation spend, including, by the way, in the life sciences, where they spend $40 billion a year just in the U.S. of life science funding for innovation. So 75% of new molecular entities with priority ratings, so these are the radical drugs, trace their research back to the National Institutes of Health. We don't have that level. If you think of even the work I did on missions, no? The mission-oriented research that I wrote about for the European Commission, on the back of which now there's a missions instrument. The total of all the missions, the five missions in Europe, or the amount of money that we put to it, is about, I think, $33 billion for all of Europe, five missions. The U.S., just for the health kind of related spend on innovation, they spend $40 billion. So that massive difference in the public sector proactive innovation, which has historically crowded in private sector innovation, mainly in the military, you know, missing in Europe. And what my work has said is, why just the military? Why don't we know how to be so ambitious on energy, sustainability, on health outcomes, and so on? And I think what the Draghi report does is, you know, there's a lot of good stuff in it, but the problem is it doesn't dismantle one of the biggest myths in Europe, which is that somehow, for example, Southern Europe was just spending too much money and they need, you know, to tighten their belts. If you actually look at the difference, all those examples I just gave between Southern Europe and Northern Europe, Southern Europe has been much, much weaker. For example, Italy, its public bank is much weaker than Germany's public bank. In Italy, we don't have Fraunhofer Institutes, which Germany has. In Italy, we don't have the, what's it called, the vocational training for working class people. Really diving down into the ecosystem of tools and institution, what works, what doesn't in Europe, including, by the way, stakeholder governance of companies, which I think is a European strength in Northern Europe, where trade unions are on the board. I think what we need is a proper report that actually unveils that kind of granular institutional difference between European countries. What have we learned works better? How can we also, you know, Italian nursery schools, by the way, are some of the best in the world. So there's Italian high schools, I think, actually are also very good in terms of the critical mindset they provide for students on philosophy and so on, much better than an American high school. So it's not about US versus Europe. It's even rendering much more granular the truth behind European competitiveness, with that actually problem in the south of Europe is they invested too little. They didn't spend too much. They invested way too little in research and development, in public, you know, active and smart public bank loans that were strategic and mission oriented, in the Fraunhofer science industry linkages. And so the problem is that by not highlighting that irony that in Europe, even after the financial crisis, all the loans to Southern Europe were conditional on austerity, basically, instead of being conditional on you must start areas that will render you more competitive. We haven't gotten rid of that logic. We have, of course, the next gen EU program now in Europe, but that didn't really transform at the member state level the capacity of governments to implement smart programs. Everyone can come up with projects around climate and digital, which was the condition to get the money. But you don't know what to do with those projects. The sum is not bigger than the parts. It doesn't lead to transformation unless you have active industrial strategies, I think mission industrial strategies, which make sure that we move away from projects to a portfolio program, which again, if you look back to the US, they've always had portfolio programs around their particular priorities.
Yes, and even the Next Generation EU, which you mentioned, has not been stabilized, right? So they are basically phasing out and not replacing with a comparable fiscal capacity.
Exactly.
That would lead me to another point. You want to comment on this?
I know. I was just saying the fiscal capacity was my point, that it continues to be driven by the old economics, which doesn't actually focus on investment.
Exactly. Having mentioned old economics, I think a lot of people who cannot, you know, really think deep about this, they reduce the whole concept of the competitiveness to, you know, reducing the administrative burden on the one hand, and on the other hand, especially in the Eastern countries, a low tax, low wage regime, which is the kind of mentality of the semi-developed countries, which just do anything and everything for foreign direct investment. And they don't realize early enough that they are actually in the race to the bottom instead of some kind of growth strategy.
Absolutely. I completely agree. And I've been writing a lot on how these European tax incentives end up being also a race to the bottom, because they're not even conditional on business investment. No, I mean, it's just trying to attract capital to Europe with this insecurity complex that we have with the US, which is all over the Draghi report, that sense of insecurity. It makes me think sometimes we need therapy as well as economic analysis. But the way to design a smart tax incentive or any subsidy, which is conditional that the private sector actually do their job and provide, you know, proper investment, but also investment in with particular characteristics, which is what Biden did, by the way, with the CHIPS Act. No, the money that went to the semiconductor companies was conditional that workers get paid more, that working conditions improve, that profits get reinvested into the economy instead of just given out to shareholders and dividend payouts. But that was an exception under Biden. And now, in fact, Trump is destroying it. But there's very little examples of that in Europe. And definitely in countries like the UK, which, you know, is out of Europe, but in Europe geographically, where because of Brexit, now they're so desperate for capital. But there's other parts of Europe that are desperate for capital, where to attract capital, they do exactly as you say, just kind of a race to the bottom. And of course, that doesn't work, because if it's just through tax, capital might come, but then it leaves because someone else will beat you later in terms of the tax incentive. So actually getting, you know, dynamic business to stick, like Denmark is an interesting example, because they are the number one providers to China of high-tech green digital services. And if you look at the history of what allowed them to become so competitive in green digital services, there's so many lessons there. First of all, it began because Copenhagen wanted to be one of the greenest cities in the world. So it had a mission, it had a vision, it had a plan. A lot of the kind of innovation hub in Copenhagen would have actually amounted to nothing, like most startups amount to nothing, had there not been that vision that these companies started to work in a more dynamic, almost networked kind of way, where the sum is bigger than the parts, working not only with the city of Copenhagen, but also with Vestas, now one of their national champions on renewable energy. So these companies, which actually ended up also servicing, in some ways, the city services that were needed for the green economy, because don't forget, sustainable mobility also has a digital side of it. Digital to me is everything, right? It's the tool that we use to, in the modern, the tool that we use basically for movement of not just goods and services, but of, you know, movement of ideas, so on and so forth. So any mission, whether it's a health mission, a sustainability mission, will always have a very strong data and increasingly AI component. And what is so interesting and what happened to in Denmark is that they had both capacity at the state level, at the national level, because they invested in organizationals like Mind Lab. I don't know if you've heard of Mind Lab. It was similar to Sitra in Finland or Vinnova in Sweden. These are like units within government that are focused on getting government to be smarter, more agile, more flexible, more willing to experiment. In Chile, by the way, they have what's called Laboratorio de Gobierno. It's like a laboratory inside the government, which helps government test new methods. Not, for example, when I talk about procurement, there's stupid ways to do procurement and there's smart ways to do procurement. So if you're going to change the law of procurement, which is often problematic, and have outcomes mission-oriented procurement, you might start testing it out. For example, with school meals, right? In Sweden, they did this: healthy, tasty, sustainable school meals for every child. What does that mean for the way that government works between the Department of Agriculture, the Department of Health, the Department of Education, Department of Finance, an interministerial war room kind of mentality, right? I say war room because in COVID and in wars, departments work together, but in normal times they're stupid and they just work in their little silo. Using missions like those around school meals, this is what Sweden did. It made their government smarter in knowing how to work in an interministerial way. That doesn't just happen. You need to invest in the capacity of government to do that. And I think, to be honest, I think the U.S. is not doing that today. The whole DOGE, D-O-G-E, rhetoric is actually reducing state capacity. And I think in Europe, if we want to be strong, we need to realize that in every country, like in Italy, every time we have a riforma della pubblica amministrazione, a reform of public administration, it's just cuts. It's just cuts. You know, it's this idea that somehow we have too many civil servants, or there's too much red tape. Oh, there's too much bureaucracy. There's too much planning. As opposed to, do we have an agile, flexible, smart, strategic civil service and public service, you know, basically state, that can govern complex processes, understand uncertainty, feedback effects, but especially work well with the private sector to achieve goals? That's what my focus is on. What is the state capacity we need for that? And it's interesting, the Draghi report doesn't even mention that. It doesn't really mention state capacity in terms of the need to invest in a more able, dynamic civil service. And it kind of in some ways repeated some of the rhetoric of, you know, oh, the US is more flexible, it's more agile, and what we need to do is more venture capital, forgetting that actually without state capacity, you can do nothing.
There is a lot of inferiority complex, I think, in this. I wanted to mention a previous involvement of yours in the EU policy when you worked with Commissioner Mrdas and Pascal Lamy in order to boost the research and innovation capacity of the European Union. And that was quite a few years ago. My question is, do you think the EU is learning fast enough? You know, because you know, we might be half right to point out that under Trump, the US is shooting themselves in the foot, but we are not upgrading ourselves fast enough in the field of you know, innovation driven economic growth.
Absolutely. And also all the work I did with Carlos Modas, who you know now is the mayor of Lisbon, only stayed in the innovation ministry. It never went to the center of the cabinet. You know, it should have gone into von der Leyen's Green Deal policy. That's where the mission should lie. That's how you do a Green Deal. Instead, it's in la mia villa sopra. Instead, it just remained inside the innovation ministry, which, you know, the DGRTD or whatever it's called now, which is also explains why it has so little money. So I think we had a kind of a schizophrenia where for innovation, we became smart, but then at the center, we didn't. And so it's the center that matters. I always say any mission, even with the work I do in Brazil, the ecological transition in Brazil is, in fact, in Lula's office, right? It's not in the Department of the Environment. So the need to bring an interministerial approach from Department of Environment, Department of Health, Department of Finance is both true at the national level, but also at the European Commission level. Instead, by putting the missions instrument, which, you know, I helped to, how do you say, innovate around, and to leave it just in the department, in the ministry for in the equivalent of a ministry. Not, it's not a ministry, it's Europe.
DG, DG. DG is the name in Brussels, Directorate General.
Yeah, exactly. DGRTD, I said before, no?
Yes.
Then they lost an opportunity because I think the Green Deal is impossible to have without a radical change, Giorna, in how government itself functions, both within, you know, between the DGs, but also within the member states, again, how they think about their own state capacity, which is what we were talking about before. So by putting it just in the innovation side, it made it seem as though this is just about innovation as opposed to a change in how we do government.
Exactly. You mentioned...
I'm sorry, that change in government requires investment. So that's what's missing both in the, you know, Draghi report. There's no real sign that we need to invest within the state to become more interministerial and smart. And at the DG level and in the EC, if you look at how the Green Deal was designed, it didn't actually then foster the conditions that should have been then required for all the member states when they accessed, you know, funds like the DG, the Next Gen EU. It should have been conditional that they actually invest in their capacity, as I said before, to implement.
Maybe this backsliding on the Green Deal is partly due to the fact that it was not emphasized sufficiently that the Green Deal is primarily an investment plan. And this backsliding, you mentioned you were in Brazil. Is it visible from there that Europe is backsliding on the green policy?
Well, yes. I mean, the biggest problem there is... the biggest problem in it for all the global South countries is that what Europe has done with the CBAM is hurting development because there's no technology transfer and knowledge transfer provisions. So it's just blocking the ability of developing countries to sell, to export to Europe if they don't have all those different green conditions. So the CBAM treaty kind of lacks the solidarity element that Europe, if it wants to also have principles of justice, equity, solidarity, not at the center of how it views itself, unlike the US. That's a huge thing that's talked about in Brazil, but also in South Africa. So in Brazil, the big issue was that it was supposed to be called the Solutions COP. Did you hear that?
Yes, Solutions COP.
A Solutions COP means there's no point in talking about policy green deals and green this, green that, if we don't invest in practical solutions that are doable, but also that dismantle the problematic structures of the solutions of the past. For example, blended finance schemes have been designed very poorly. There's very little additionality, very little directionality. There's socialization of risk, privatization of rewards. And so what was interesting for me in Brazil this year, for COP at least, was the focus on, you know, understanding why, you know, why, well, first of all, why don't we have implementation capacity? Again, in Italy, for example, we end up having to send back the money to Europe often that we get for structural funds because we haven't invested in that. But also, if we do invest in it, what do we know? What works, what doesn't? So one of the things that I've been doing with Brazil is, for example, with the health goals, combining them with the green goals underneath one umbrella called the Health Economy Industrial Complex, where the lessons, in fact, that I was mentioning before from the U.S. military machine is that they invested, but then they made sure that the soldiers on the battlefield had access to the goods, whereas for the rest of the U.S. economy, they invest, but then the people don't have access, right? Like in the health care area, you have the NIH, which I mentioned before, then a very weak welfare state. So as we know, the U.S. is terrible on the rankings of health outcomes. But that's also true. That's also true of many global South countries. People do not have access to the goods, even when the public sector itself is actually investing, let alone when it's not investing. So what's interesting in Brazil, which I've been working with, is how do you bring under one roof the investment side and the demand side, so kind of the welfare side. So put in my language, it's the entrepreneurial state and the welfare state under one roof. Instead, what usually happens is you have people talking about entrepreneurship, the Draghi report, biotech, nanotech, AI in one room. And then in another room, the people who actually care about inequality and, you know, poverty and whatever. So if you start with the fact that we want an economy that serves people and planet and break it down into goals, which I always say start with the SDGs because we all signed up to them, not because I say, but you have signed up to them, turn them into goals at the city level, regional level, national level, and then think of your investment plan, which is going to generate solutions for the SDGs, but always with the idea of inclusion at the center. So again, that people have access to the benefits that we have actually very explicit ways to share the rewards of, you know, an energy transition and so on. And that's, by the way, what Biden didn't do. Biden had a whole green plan, but he didn't actually put at the center, you know, the distributional kind of effects, how people would also feel the benefits of it. And I think that's why ultimately he didn't win, because even though economically there was good results, of the IRA, it wasn't actually designed. And this is where your point of progressive economics is very important. It wasn't designed in a progressive way to make sure that the benefits really went to some of the more not only disadvantaged communities, but that people in those communities would feel part of something bigger than themselves. And this is probably one of the things I'm most interested in now. How do we not work at citizens, but with them? How do we increase the dignity they've lost, the value, the sense of that their bodies, their lives have value? I see this in London, where the increase in crime is directly related, I think, to a lot of young people falling through the cracks, and their own life has no value. So your life has no value. I can stab you to death easily if a body, my own skin, has no value, no? And so how do we as progressives care just as much as, you know, investment-led growth, sustainable transition, the Green Deal, but bring it down to the ground so that we work with people to design those very, you know, missions even that I talk about. So I did that in different places, like in Camden, where I live in London. We worked with people in Camden Council, even in the poorest sections, like where there's food banks. We transformed the food banks into food cooperatives, green food cooperatives, where people had dignity. It was the same amount of food they were getting from the food bank, but in a food cooperative, they owned the agenda. They governed it. You know, had ownership of the basically what was still a food bank, but as a cooperative. And that sense of dignity, giving people back dignity that they've lost, I think it's one of the most important things of our time. And if we don't do it, it fuels populism, not because then someone else comes along and it says, oh, but oh no, I'll listen to you. All those lefties, they just talk in their nice big debates. But we are here to help you, and we understand why you don't have a job, and it's because of the African immigrants or whatever the story is told. And it's interesting, by the way, in Italy, for example, it was the Communist Party that used to have a real presence on the ground, on the streets. Now it's the Lega, or I mean, this was already 20 years ago, the transformation. The communists stopped having their mutual help organizations in every corner, and it became the Lega Nord, which had that. So the rise of the right, both in the US, in Brexit, Britain, but also the Lega kind of parties in Italy, have in some ways replaced the left on the streets.
A very last and a brief one. Because you also mentioned that you were partly inspired by Pauline, even writing about regulating markets and shaping markets. In the book which you co-edited with Michael Jacobs, I think the collective, which also included Stiglitz and others, it's also not only Polanyian, but of course with Stiglitz there is a Keynesian tradition, there's a Schumpeterian tradition. And would you encourage the young generation to look into these classics?
Of course, of course. They're central, but we need to go beyond them too. For example,
Tell
you
me.
know, I mean, obviously Keynes, for all the emphasis on not only counter-cyclical government, but taking demand side, seriously, right? Coming back to my point before, there's no point in having all these policies if you don't also stimulate demand. Minsky on the very important analysis of how the financialization of the economy. This is what I wrote about in my book, The Value of Everything. Now, so Minsky, an analysis of how finance finances finance, which of course, dates back to Marx as well. Schumpeter for his emphasis on innovation. My PhD was on Schumpeterian economics. Like all these writers are so important, and my work and other people's work has done that. But I think what we need for the youth is to bring to that also the analysis also again of participatory structures, because that's what they want. I mean, a lot of the youth are not interested in just in the blah blah blah, as you said before, technocratic solutions. So how do we make sure that we bring also theories of, I don't know, Paulo Freire, from Brazil, in terms of, community participation. How do we learn from the commons, Eleanor Ostrom's work? My new book, which I've just finished, I've just submitted it to Penguin. It's coming out in a year. It's called Common Good Economics. And it's a critique of the public good, as just being a correction for something the private sector doesn't do, right? When you have non-excludable, non-rival areas, we expect the public sector to invest in clean water and defense systems and basic R&D. So that's really a theory of the private. It's not a theory of the public. If the private sector doesn't do something, we expect the public sector to fill the gap. And then the theory of the commons, of Eleanor Ostrom, is, I think, very important because it brings analysis to the community level, but it also is sort of in a failure fixing mode. Instead of market failure, it talks about government failure. So what I talk about in Common Good Economics is we have to go beyond this failure fixing, and we need to bring together, and I talk about all sorts of different theorists, but this is sort of an accumulation of my own work on, again, mission and market shaping and so on. But Common Good Economics has to be about an objective, not a correction, and where the how we relate to each other, how we co-create, how we participate, how we share rewards, how we share knowledge and learning, coming back to the problems with the CBAM treaty, is as important as the what we're trying to achieve. And if you look back at political philosophy from Aristotle, but also Sandel today in his critique of Rawls, they've always paid as much attention to the how as to the what. Il telos, the telos. The goal and the polis, POLIS, the community. And we don't have an equivalent in economics of that. And so that's what I try to do in this book. It's divided in three parts: theory, policy, and practice, like spaces, places. And I hope it will be useful to the world.
Well, thank you very much for this teaser. I think it's extremely helpful at the end. Thanks so much for having the time for us. despite your busy travel schedule.
Anyway, thank you so much. And I'm, it's an honor. Thank you. I should have said it from the beginning.
No,
thank you for thinking
for
of
us,
me.
It's an honor.